This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib, collects memos from the State Department, the Defense Department, and the military, as well as their respective lawyers, on the Al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. The memos discuss whether the Geneva Conventions should apply to these prisoners and defines acceptable forms of coercive interrogation. The book also collects reports on conditions at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. A little later, we'll hear from former Justice Department lawyer John Yoo, who wrote several of the memos collected in the book, including one advising that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to Al-Qaeda members or the Taliban. My first guests are the editors of the book, The Torture Papers. Karen Greenberg is the executive director of the Center on Law and Security at the New York University School of Law. Joshua Dreitel is on the board of directors of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and is currently assisting in the defense of Guantanamo detainees. We've already heard some of the, you know, greatest hits, so to speak, from some of these memos, some of the quotes that have been repeated a lot. But what story do the documents tell when they're all placed together in sequential order, stories that you wouldn't necessarily get from quotes out of context?
I think the evolution of the policy is clear from the memos altogether, that you don't get from one in particular or one particular snippet, and that is that it was done in a very calculated fashion, initially to find a location that was outside the rule of law, or at least that the government thought was outside the rule of law, and it turns out the Supreme Court rejected that. But then that was number one. Number two was,
and you're talking about Guantanamo there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then the second part was to manufacture a basis for rejecting international law such as the Geneva Convention. And then the third part was to then ensure that those who acted pursuant to this policy were absolved from war crimes prosecutions themselves.
Well, Joshua Dreitel, you said that the first goal in these memos was to find a place to put a prison that was outside the rule of law, Guantanamo. Can you read an excerpt of a memo that shows what you mean there?
Sure. It's the December 28th, 2001 memo from Patrick Philbin and John Yoo to the General Counsel of the Department of Defense, William Haynes. And I'll just read you the first sentence, which states the purpose, which is, this memorandum addresses the question whether a federal district court would properly have jurisdiction to entertain a petition for a writ of habeas corpus filed on behalf of an alien detained at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This question has arisen because of proposals to detain Al-Qaeda and Taliban members at Guantanamo Bay pending a possible trial by military commission. And essentially, that is the concern. And obviously, if you were confident that you were operating within the norms of international law and the Geneva Convention, you would not have to find a place that was outside habeas jurisdiction.
I'm going to ask you each to choose a memo that you find to be particularly revealing about the strategy in creating the prisons, in the interrogation techniques that were used, or in the decision, you know, not to follow the Geneva Conventions for the Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters. Can you each choose a short excerpt of a memo that you think is particularly important?
This is a memo that Alberto Gonzalez, who is the nominee to be Attorney General of the United States, wrote to the president. It was on January 25th, 2002. And in this memo, he lays out the pros and cons of whether or not the United States should step away from the Geneva Convention in the treatment of prisoners of war, and specifically in response to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. He writes this memo because Colin Powell has asked him to please think about and present to the president clearly what the pros and cons of such a policy would be. And what Gonzalez determines is that it is important that the United States not feel itself beholden to the Geneva Conventions. And the reason is that it will preserve flexibility and it will reduce the threat of domestic criminal prosecution under the War Crimes Act. And if you want me to read a quote,
yes, please.
I will read this one. A determination, this is under the negatives, a determination that the Geneva Convention does not apply to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban could undermine U.S. military culture, which emphasizes maintaining the highest standards of conduct in combat, and could introduce an element of uncertainty in the status of adversaries. I think that this gives you a sense of just how much the United States thought that if they stuck to the rules, if they stuck to the rules both political and military, they were convinced that they would be weakened in this war against al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Karen Greenberg, the memo that you just read, that's the famous memo that has Gonzalez talking about how aspects of the Geneva Convention have been rendered quaint. Could you just read that paragraph for us and tell us what that paragraph means to you?
As you have said, the war against terrorism is a new kind of war. It is not the traditional clash between nations adhering to the laws of war that form the backdrop for the Geneva Convention 3. The nature of the new war places a high premium on other factors, such as the ability to quickly obtain information from captured terrorists and their sponsors in order to avoid further atrocities against American civilians, and the need to try terrorists for war crimes such as wantonly killing civilians. In my judgment, this new paradigm renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions requiring that captured enemy be afforded such things as commissary privileges, scrip, i.e. advances of monthly pay, athletic uniforms, and scientific instruments.
Reading that paragraph, which we've heard quoted a lot, in the context of all of the released memos, what does that paragraph say to you?
Well, I think it says two things. The first is the renders quaint does reveal that the administration was thinking that they needed a new concept of the law in order to fight this war, it turns out, both at home and abroad. But if you go on to the last part of what I read about what they mean by what is quaint, there's nothing particularly devastating there, nothing that would particularly scare you, right? Commissary privileges, scrip, athletic uniforms, and scientific instruments. However, when the policies came into being, they were much more harmful than the removal of these kinds of privileges, and they had to do with inhumane treatment. And so what becomes apparent here is that when they wrote this, they were unlikely thinking about athletic uniforms. And somehow, in talking about rendering things quaint, they knew that they were taking a step away and tried to back themselves up by making it look like it was a much less egregious stepping outside of the law than it was actually going to be. Nevertheless, it set the basis for moving away from the Geneva Convention.
Joshua Dreitel, do you want to read an excerpt of a memo?
Sure. I have an October 11th, 2002 memo from Gerald Pfeiffer, and it's from the Joint Task Force at Guantanamo Bay to the commander of the Joint Task Force, and it is a request for approval of counter-resistance strategies. And it states a problem, which is defined as the current guidelines for interrogation procedures at Gitmo limit the ability of interrogators to counter advanced resistance. And the solution is a request approval for use of the following interrogation plan. And they have Category 1 techniques, Category 2 techniques, and Category 3 techniques. And the Category 1 techniques obviously describe certain techniques such as yelling, deception, multiple interrogator techniques. The interviewer may identify himself as a citizen of a foreign nation or as an interrogator from a country with a reputation for harsh treatment of detainees. Category 2 is a little bit more severe, the use of stress positions like standing for a maximum of 4 hours, the use of falsified documents or reports, isolation for up to 30 days, interrogating the detainee, quote, in an environment other than the standard interrogation booth, the close quote. Then there's the deprivation of light and auditory stimuli, hoods placed over the head during transportation and questioning, 20-hour interrogations, removal of all comfort items, including religious items, switching the detainee from hot rations to MREs, which are meals ready to eat, which are those that are used in the field by the military, removal of clothing, forced grooming, which includes the shaving of facial hair, and the last one, using detainees individual phobias such as fear of dogs to induce stress. And then we go to Category 3, which ratchets up another level, which is the use of scenarios designed to convince the detainee that death or severely painful consequences are imminent for him and or his family, exposure to cold weather or water with appropriate medical monitoring, it says, the use of a wet towel and dripping water to induce the misperception of suffocation, and the use of mild, non-injurious physical contact, such as grabbing, poking in the chest with the finger, and light pushing.
Category 3, though, there's a caveat on that. Those cannot just be used. Those have to be.
Right. The techniques in this category may be used only by submitting a request through the director, JIG, for approval by the commanding general with appropriate legal review and information to the commander of SOUTHCOM, which is essentially the commander of the whole region.
So in other words, for the most extreme of those techniques that are described, you need a permission from the higher-ups. So what does this memo tell you?
I think these memos and also the memos from General Hill, which are, I think, a part of this whole section of the volume, also demonstrates to a certain extent what a significant departure this kind of treatment was from traditional military detention of persons taken on a battlefield, whether or not you describe them as prisoners of war or enemy combatants or whatever they may be determined. And there was no real determination here by any competent tribunal, which is what the Geneva Convention requires. But the point is that the military was essentially operating in uncharted waters because there was no existing protocol for treating detainees in this fashion. And it essentially had to be approved and submitted for approval because it did not exist beforehand. And in addition, I think also the military, because of the whole question of reciprocity in terms of what happens to our soldiers when they are captured by the enemy, I think the military had a significant reluctance to engage in this conduct unless it was specifically ordered and approved by the civilian hierarchy within the Department of Defense.
Joshua Dreitel, one of the concerns you express in the book is that lawyers within the Bush administration were treated like corporate lawyers. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that in the context of government service, it's different than when you have a specific client, such as a corporation or a person, and your role as a lawyer is zealous representation, and you're trying to facilitate essentially what the client is objectives are without making an independent decision or having any other countervailing considerations. Whereas a government lawyer, other than the law itself, I mean, you wouldn't give advice that were contrary to the law or do something unethical. But government lawyers, I think, have a different obligation, which is also to the Constitution and to uphold it. So in the sense that pursuing an agenda that is contrary to the Constitution violates their role within the government. They each take an oath and they're obligated to uphold it. So independent of what they're doing for their immediate boss or their department boss who may want to pursue a specific policy, they have to independently evaluate whether that's also consistent with the law, with the Constitution. And I think in this case, there was a failure to do that.
Joshua Dreitel and Karen Greenberg are the editors of the new book, The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib.